So this is an interview with Georgia Heath on the 11th of December 2017 in Bowdoin, South Australia. This is recording is part of the Women's History Project. Now, Georgia, would you please give me your full name and a brief overview of when and where you were born and grew up?
Sure. So I'm Georgia Annie Heath, and I was born in 1982, and I grew up in the northern suburbs of Adelaide. I was born in Gawler, but then grew up primarily in Salisbury, and went to Salisbury Primary School and Chepps Cross Girls High School.
Okay. So when did you start? How did you get involved with the Women's Information Service, as it probably was by the time you got there?
It was. So I remember going to the I think it was still a switchboard, actually, when I went at high school.
And you went when you were at Chepps Cross High?
Yeah. So with Chepps Cross Girls High School, we had some phenomenal teachers who made sure that we were really well connected to women's services and the Women's Resource Centre.
Where I also
and,
worked?
Yes.
I was there in 1990, I think.
Oh, fabulous. Mm. Yeah. So so all of those services, the teachers at Chepps Cross were fantastic to get us really well connected. And incidentally, when I was a manager at the Women's Information Service, Fiona Mort, who is now the director of the Office of Women, she also went to Chepps Cross Girls. So,
oh, right. Didn't know that.
Yeah, two of the three of us that were managers at the time that I was there had gone to Chepps Cross Girls High School. So I think there might be something in the waters there.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So I came across the switchboard whilst I was at school. And then I went on to uni, and at uni I got very involved in activism and student politics, and I came across the Women's Information Service as it was then through the work that we were doing through the Students Association. So when an opportunity came up when I was then working in state government, so I'd left uni and left my student politics days behind me, and I'd gone on to work in the state government, first for the History Trust and then for the Office of the Chief Information Officer. And I was looking for something that was short term because I wanted a new role, but I was thinking about going overseas to work for a few years. And this opportunity came up to do a 6-month place at the Women's Information Service as the manager. And I thought, yeah, that sounds great. You know, it's 6 months. That'll work nicely for me to go overseas. Really, really wanted to work for the Office for Women. That was something that was, you know, on my list of dream jobs. And I had that opportunity to apply for the role and not thinking at all that I would get it. But I sent off my application and I included a lot of the information from my student politics and activist days at uni. And I got an interview and I was absolutely chuffed, and I went off to the interview and I brought along a package of things that I'd done at uni. So things, you know, we'd had some bookmarks that we'd made about education rights and welfare rights, and we had some brochures about employment opportunities for students and all sorts of things like that. And I took it along to the interview, and I remember the interview was Vanessa Swan. Yeah, so it was Vanessa Swan who was the, she was the acting director then for the Office for Women. Fiona Mort, who was the manager of policy at that time, and Fliss Lord, who was the chair of the WIS support group at that point in time. And so off I went, and it was fantastic. Like the interview felt a bit like coming home. It was people who were clearly my kind of people. You know, I'd gone off and worked in ICT areas of government for a while, and it was really lovely to go back into an area of work and particularly an area of government that was fundamentally feminist and fundamentally about improving people's lives and improving outcomes for women. And it felt wonderful to have that interview. And it felt even more wonderful when Vanessa rang me to say that I'd been offered the job. And I remember when Vanessa called me to say I'd been offered the job, I was in Las Vegas, and I was standing out the front of the Cher concert because I was with my cousins on a holiday overseas, and we were just about to go in to see Cher's concert, and Vanessa called me to say, oh, look, you've been successful. I said, that's fabulous, but I have to go now. I've got to go and see Cher. And so I hung up the phone and went in, and I was so excited, and I got back from that holiday and started not long afterwards. And
so what year was this?
So that would have been 2010.
So who had been the coordinator just before you?
So when I started, WIS had been going through a period of upheaval. It was around the time of the Sustainable Budget Commission cuts, mm-hmm. and I didn't know it when I applied for the job. I arrived for my first day of work, and Vanessa took me aside and she said, Georgia, there's something that I haven't told you, and that is that this role is actually to figure out what's going to happen with the future of the Women's Information Service. And we need to pretty quickly figure out whether or not there's going to continue to be a Women's Information Service. And I said, thanks, Vanessa. That's not quite the job that I thought that I'd applied for, but I tell you what, that sounds like a really interesting job, and I'm really happy to do that. But yeah, it wasn't until my first day that I found that out. And so the Women's Information Service had really gone through a tough time in the period before I started, and in the period whilst I was there. So it had had a number of managers in the years before I'd started. Carla, I can't remember like Carla's last name, but Carla had been the manager not long before I'd been there. And she had taken over from somebody else who'd been there for a couple of years. I think she'd taken over from Sophie Aloesh, actually.
Oh, okay. So yeah, after, I know Sophie.
Yeah, so after Sophie had left that role, it really had a lot of temporary contracts, a lot of uncertainty. And it wasn't just the Women's Information Service, it was the Office for Women. So Vanessa was an acting director at that point in time as well, and she had been appointed after other acting directors too. So it was really in a time of, you know, real question about whether or not, I think not just the Women's Information Service, but was the Office for Women going to continue to exist. And that was a really hard time. So the staff that had been there at the time that I started, there were some staff who had been there for a long time. Actually, most of the staff had been there for a long time.
So who was still on the paid staff in those days?
So Lise was a paid staff member. Shannon Peake was a paid staff member. Patrice, I can't remember Patrice's last name, but she was a paid staff member. And she'd been acting as the manager just before me starting. And she then moved into a new role not long after I left. Not long after I started, she went over to a housing provider. Maddie Paddingale had only just started when I started at WIS. Annika Levi was there as well. Annika had been there for several years, probably about 10 years. And Mel Heap, although she wasn't working in the WIS team at that time, was still in the Office for Women and very much around. Trying to remember, they were the core
so
they group.
Were the paid staff. And core what about the long-term volunteers? Did you have some of them still there then?
Absolutely. So Pat, of course, and Anna. We had beautiful Mari, who unfortunately has passed away. We had some younger volunteers as well. So Gemma and Laura, who I think both became paid staff members, were some of the more recent volunteers to come into that group. Caroline, of course, who was fantastic in her role as the volunteer liaison officer. Mm-hmm. So she would come to our staff meetings and do all of that. She was fabulous. Trying to remember who else. There was, I'm struggling to remember the name of this, Jenny. Jenny, I don't know if Jenny is still volunteering there now, but Jenny would come in every Wednesday and do our media board, and she'd clip out articles. And Jenny was fantastic because she'd actually been, I think, the national training coordinator for the ATO, and had actually been my mum's boss about...
Oh, really?
Yeah, about 20 years beforehand. Mm-hmm. And she had all of this knowledge and she would casually mentor me with things. So she'd just, every now and then, she'd just throw in something about change management or something in those spaces. She was fabulous. And the other person who's another fabulous woman whose name is escaping me right now, but it starts with a W. Oh, it'll come back to me.
We can fill it in later. Hopefully I'll transcribe this interview later.
Oh, fabulous.
And so if you come up with a name, you can let me know and I can put it in. Oh, the
I can picture her face.
The woman whose name starts with W.
In, and she used to live down the street here on Chief Street.
Yeah.
Or on Hawker Street.
Well, we can fill that in, don't worry.
It's going to bother me.
Yeah.
But yeah, so at the time that I started, it had gone through this real sense of upheaval.
And so where were you located by then?
So we were located...
In the railway...
No, arcade? So this was after the railway arcade.
Okay, this is when you're on Chess on Grenfell Street?
On Grenfell Street. And so the Women's Information Service was located next door to the Office for Women.
Mm-hmm.
And that had been creating some tension, I think, at that point in time. So it was really, really gone through a bit of an upheaval and numbers had been dropping in terms of the number of women coming to use the service. There hadn't been a strong sense of direction going forward. The volunteer program hadn't been really adequately resourced for a while. And not anything that it was intentional. It was just, it was a period of time where there were just... lots of little cuts. So, you know, a 0.2 of an FTE here and a 0.4 of an FTE there. And, you know, eventually you get to the point where you go, well, hang on, how many people have we got left? And we've got enough people to open the doors.
And how do you provide services and how do you provide cover?
That's exactly right.
Without many people, yeah.
That's exactly
tricky,
right.
Because you always need to have the paid staff as well as the volunteers.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I remember my first day walking in and there'd been an issue in the shop front and the volunteers were doing a huge amount of work that I think in the past would have potentially been done by paid workers or should have been resourced to have been done by paid workers, but that hadn't necessarily stayed in resourced in a way that it needed to be. So there were some big questions at that point in time about what was going to happen in the future. And I think probably behind the scenes there'd already been a lot of work done by people in the Office for Women, by the WIS support group, by the minister to try and make sure we were going to keep the Women's Information Service going. But it had got to a point where we really needed to take stock and reflect and to make some choices about if we were going to keep going. What was that going to look like? And answering that question of was the Women's Information Service going to continue? So that was, the job that I ended up having.
Yes, well, that's a challenging time.
Yeah. But it was fantastic. So before I'd even started, they'd come in, Vanessa had arranged for the group that does the safety standards for healthcare. To come in and do an audit to find out where we were up to. And one of the beautiful things that came out of that audit was to really talk about the strengths of the Women's Information Service. And one of the real strengths there was the volunteers. And we really quickly understood that we needed to properly resource the volunteers going forward to be able to really... utilize such a wonderful group of people that were wanting to put up their hand and volunteer and often for we had people who'd been volunteering for more than 20 years by that stage.
That's right.
And really seeing that as a strength of the service. So the audit had been done and then we needed to go on a bit of a journey together with other women's organizations, with the WIS support group, with staff and with volunteers to decide where the future was going to go. So we ended up having a bit of a strategy day, a bit of a policy day, where we closed the shop front. And I think it was the first time that we closed the shop front. We kept the telephone line going, but the actual shop front was closed. And we did it because we knew it was so serious that we needed to have everyone there.
needed to regroup.
Yeah, so we went over and we held it at the in the chapel at the Migration Museum, and we had a really tough day but a really positive day. And by the end of that day, we'd made some decisions about what needed to happen into the future. And those decisions included we were going to move to a model where the shop front wasn't going to be open every day, and it was going to be open for shorter hours on the days that it was open. And that was because we just didn't have the
resources
to continue. But we'd also decided that we were going to have a stronger focus on technology and a stronger focus on community engagement, and understanding that women coming to us was almost a last resort, and that what we wanted to do was move into a space where we're proactively putting information out into the community and utilising this at the time new technology called Facebook. We were one of the very first government departments to utilise Facebook as service delivery. And that was probably one of the biggest changes that happened whilst I was there. So
I was involved in getting the first ever computers at West.
Yeah.
So at the very beginning of that technology development.
Absolutely. And I think WIS has always been at the forefront of technology development. You know, we talked a lot at that time about...
That was in the 90s.
Yeah.
We got our first computers.
Absolutely. And
we had a network, and we were very pleased with ourselves. We had this little
absolutely.
Network.
Well, and I think WIS was at the forefront of, you know, effectively being the switchboard, but being able to transfer calls and having the technology to be able to transfer calls and the whole philosophy that sat behind why that was important.
The warm transfer.
Yeah, it was phenomenal. And, you know, that's a piece of technology that's taken for granted now, but it's such an important piece of technology. And then going into the 90s with computers, as well as going into, you know, I'm not sure if you were there, Liz, when the ATM was at WIS. But there was a bank.
Oh, the ATO?
Yeah. No, the ATM. So there was a banking program when
yes,
ATMs
I remember
were
that
new.
There was financial advice and things.
Oh no, this
but
was
I didn't
having
know
a,
there was an ATM.
Yeah. So there, when ATMs were new technology, there was an ATM at WIS so that people could go in, and, so that women could
and
go
practice.
In and practice using the ATM, so they didn't have to do it
in
on
public.
The street. Which was phenomenal, and
that was a really good idea.
So I think WIS has always been at the forefront of technology. And definitely when it comes to government service provision, WIS was absolutely at the forefront when it came to technology, when it came to social media, and was one of the first organisations that really embraced that. So we didn't close WIS. We very much decided that WIS was an incredibly important service, but because we needed to explore new ways of doing things and make sure that we were relevant, and look at the way we could be much more cost-effective with how we structured our services, we went into this world of social media. And I think WIS continuing to do some fantastic stuff in that space, which is,
So what about services to... One of the things about Switchboard, for me, that was unique when it started, was that we had a Greek women's worker, an Italian worker, and when we had Aboriginal workers, then Aboriginal women came. By the time you were there, those roles had evaporated more or less, hadn't they?
Yeah, by the time I was there, they'd well and truly gone. Yeah. We didn't have those kind
so
of...
So how were services provided to those sorts of groups of women who are always on the edge of disadvantage?
So that's where the community engagement strategy came in. So as well as the technology strategy, we had the community engagement strategy. And that was about taking our services out to women who wouldn't ordinarily get to us. So at the time that I was there, we still had outreach that we did to McGill Youth Training Centre for women there. Annika did that. And we started the outreach service with the Ombudsman when I was there, which I think I hope still goes. It was a fantastic program, and really acknowledging that the women who come to see the Ombudsman, well, that there were very few women coming to the Ombudsman, and that those women that were coming were quite middle class women, and some of the issues that started to get resolved through our ombudsman partnership were, you know, things like decisions about disability support, things that wouldn't necessarily have made it to the ombudsman otherwise, but resulted in sometimes thousands of dollars of benefit for individual women, or changes to policy and process that made things easier for instance, for women experiencing homelessness and women who were finding other types of hardship and disadvantage. We also, at that time, had sent women's information stalls or displays in a number of libraries and community centres around the state. So we had dedicated spaces in those libraries and community centres to get information out. And we also had partnerships that we continued to run with different providers. So, for instance, with a lot of the migrant women's services, with services for Aboriginal women, with many of the DV services and so on. So it was about partnership and really understanding that we couldn't do it all, that we needed to be working with those people who were set up and equipped to be able to do it, much more than we had been. But, you know, I know in the past Wiz had done stuff that I just thought was fabulous, like having going on different language radio shows and really engaging in a range of different ways around diversity and getting out to in a range of different ways to women who need the services. And I think we tried as best as we could when I was there, but that was one of the things that I think sadly through the changes in resourcing we just weren't able to continue to maintain
those diverse background workers.
Yeah.
It's tricky. It's definitely tricky to have people from a range of backgrounds.
Absolutely.
But I noticed at the time I was there, because I was there at the beginning, and then I was there again sort of middle 80s, and then I was working there by the end, up until about 1990, I guess. And I could see every time we had workers with a particular language who were doing radio programs and in touch with their communities, the women from those communities would just pour in. When we had a Vietnamese worker, for instance, or when we had Aboriginal workers, it made a huge difference to the number of women who would come in or who would ring up compared to when they weren't there.
But,
you know, you can't always do that, but it went, at its time, I think it was fairly innovative when it started.
Oh, definitely.
Sorts of programs were really innovative when they started, and that's when all the radio programs and things were happening.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then that Every Women's Survival Guide, did you ever see that?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, well, I was part of the project that put that together. I was the project leader.
Yeah.
I went to a meeting and ended up being involved in producing that, and we ended up doing that in Vietnamese and Spanish Greek and Italian. So we tried to get it, even though some of those languages literacy is an issue. We tried to get that information out to those communities that way as well. So
absolutely,
it's interesting how things change over time.
Oh, definitely, and it's interesting because, you know, I was reflecting as you were talking about that on where some of our decision making was around how to broaden our scope in the budgetary realities that we had. And so one of the things that we did whilst I was there, because we looked at that community engagement, so getting out to and having partnerships and getting out to other organisations and out to women in community settings. But the other thing that we did was, again, looking at the technology aspect of it and acknowledging that so Facebook was pretty new still then, and Twitter and Pinterest, but starting to get into those spaces. But then talking much more broadly about the role of technology. And because one of the things that we discovered whilst I was there was that Wikipedia at that point in time only had, I think, 15%... Actually, no, less than that. It was 13% of contributors to Wikipedia were women in 2010. And so what that meant was that as we got more and more, we as a society got more and more of our information online and more of our information from Wikipedia, less of that information was being produced by women than we perhaps would have...
By women for women.
Yeah. And so it wasn't just that the content on Wikipedia was primarily being written by men, but it was also that the content on Wikipedia was about men's issues. So at that point in time, not that Star Wars is a men's... I think I'm going to see the movie when it comes out at midnight next week. But Star Wars had pages and pages and pages on Wikipedia, and Sex in the City had almost nothing.
Yeah.
And it was a big issue. So who was creating content online was an issue, as well as then trying to tap into the opportunities that technology created to enable a much more diverse range of women to access the information that they needed.
Mm. That's right. There's a bit of a class divide too.
Absolutely.
Mm. And education levels affect how people access the internet.
Absolutely. But some of the tools that are available, things like being able to translate things into any language, are new tools that just didn't exist before. So whereas in the past, if you wanted to translate information into Italian or Spanish or Greek or whatever language it might be, you'd have to find a translator and do that. We were starting to get to the point where you could enter it in and Google would do that work for you.
Yeah, it's not very good though, according to all the translators and interpreters that I know. It's very basic level, but it's better than no.
Well,
it's not very good in terms of grammar and literary quality.
Well,
apparently.
Not necessarily.
According to my friends who's bilingual.
Yeah, not necessarily.
But some of it's very useful to get through a lot of basic information.
Well, what it does is it means that if you are, say you're a woman who speaks very little English, your ability to access information
is limited, yeah.
With these translators online becomes much bigger because you don't have to find someone. Your computer can do it for you.
Yeah.
But what's really important then is that you've got someone who, or you've got people making the kinds of products and services that you need.
Mm.
So if only 10% or if only 13% of the people making products and services are online are women, then there's not very many people who are making products and services for women who really need them.
Yeah.
So part of what we did whilst I was there was start to look at what role can technology have to become a much bigger, I don't want to use the word equaliser, but it's the one that's coming to mind, but how can technology help? And so we had a summit called Powerful Users or Digital Losers, Reimagining Women Online.
Yeah.
And we invited not just women, but primarily women from all around the globe, actually. We had Genevieve Bell, who came over from Portland. She's Adelaide born, but she came over from Portland to talk about this issue. We had women from Sydney and Melbourne to come and talk about how can we use technology to help to better empower all women to live better, happier, healthier, safer lives.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to say we figured it all out then, but we didn't.
Oh, well, it's an ongoing issue.
It is an ongoing issue.
Of course it is.
And what happened for me then coming out of that, so we had these great conversations at WIS about how can we do that. What happened for me personally then was after I left the Women's Information Service, I went on to do some other work, and this question of how can technology help to better empower women's lives kind of stuck around. So I... eventually in my personal life, was so interested by this question that I started at WIS that I quit my full-time job. Mm. And now that's what I do. I make technology that helps to empower women to live happier, healthier, safer lives.
Oh, good. Are you getting funding for it, eh?
Sometimes, yes. So we actually we got funding from the Office for the Aging to create a site called Spare Time, which was primarily based on my observations at the Women's Information Service of Volunteers. So we would have these very capable women who were highly educated, highly capable, you know, people just like yourselves, Liz, who had these phenomenal skill sets. But often volunteering opportunities, including at the Office for Women, would be really boring, really mundane roles that wouldn't necessarily use a woman's full suite of skills and to use her brain in the way that we could be. Mm-hmm. And Pat was really one of the key people who influenced my thinking around this. Mm-hmm. And so we pitched this idea to the Office for the Aging that we'd create this thing called Spare Time to help connect skilled volunteers with organisations that needed them most. And they did end up giving us funding to develop this. Mm-hmm. And it all came from looking at the strengths of the Women's Information Service and the things that they that the women there fundamentally do, and trying to figure out how to do that at a sense of scale. So we do sometimes get funny, but the Women's Information Service was absolutely a strong influence in doing that, and continues to be one of the biggest influences on the work that I do now.
Yes, it's interesting. I was talking to Leanna Buchanan. Do you know her?
No.
She used to be at the Women's Legal Service, and she was at WIS as a volunteer.
Yeah.
And she's now the Commissioner for Young People in Victoria.
Yeah, yeah.
And she was saying how she still reflects on her time at WIS and how that influences when she's thinking about policy for women and young girls.
Yeah.
That when she's thinking about those sorts of things, she reflects on the kinds of calls and the visits that she had with people.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
How that influences what she's doing now. So it's interesting.
Absolutely.
Once you've been at WIS, it sort of permeates your life sort of.
Oh, it really does. Ways, yeah. It really does. And
because
even
you remember those really critical calls that you had with people.
Oh, absolutely.
You?
Well, and even so one of the other projects I'm working on is called Spare B, and that's the idea. It's looking at Airbnb but for emergency accommodation, and particularly around domestic violence. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's still very much in conceptual stages, but it's, you know, when I talk about that, I get up and I talk about knowing what it feels like to tell someone that they don't have somewhere to sleep that night. Mm-hmm. And I fundamentally base that story on a conversation I had with a regular client who would come in every day to use the computers, and she was an incredibly smart woman who had had a very, very, very bad run at life, and she had overcome several different types of addiction. At the time that I knew her, she was struggling with pokey addiction. But she would come in every day, and she was so lovely, and she would get on to her email and check out her email, and her addiction caused her to, she was living in a hostel, and she ended up being in a space where she needed to, she'd been evicted from that hostel, and she needed to find emergency accommodation that night, and she had wanted to go home with one of our volunteers, but things had changed in the period of time up until I got there to recognise more around boundaries, to recognise more around risk, and to recognise more around how we structure professional relationships. So it was a very clear rule that volunteers and paid staff could not, for instance, take a woman home.
Yeah.
And this rule had been broken in that space. And so one of our volunteers had said, you can come home with me. And I'd found out about it. And as the manager, and it was horrible. It was a dark and rainy night. It was, you know, something like you'd read in a book. It was 10 to 5. And I went to see her and I said, I'm really sorry, but you can't go home with this person tonight. I said, I know that this means that you might not have somewhere to sleep tonight, and I'm really sorry, but this is our rule, and this is why we have the rule, and you can't do that. And I went home, and I felt like crap the entire weekend. I was so worried, and, you know, I just thought, you know, where is this woman sleeping? This is somebody who I saw on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And where was she sleeping, and what was happening? And when I saw her again the following Monday, it was interesting. She actually apologised to me for putting me in that position. And I felt awful that I had to say to her, this is, you know, we can't do this. Mm-hmm. Now, she had ended up with somewhere to stay that weekend, which relieved me, but it didn't take away the fundamental problem. Mm. And part of the problem that I started to see when I was at WIS was that there wasn't the tools to help put people in accommodation as quickly as it needed to be. Mm. So at 10 to 5 on a Friday night, when we knew that this woman had nowhere to sleep, it was too late to call the homelessness services. There wasn't an online calendar where we could see where vacancies were, because information at that point in time, and I think it still is, about...
Still pretty tight.
Really tight. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's done on whiteboards. It's done with people knowing where the vacancies are. It's done with really basic kind of tools. Mm. And it just shouldn't be, you know.
There are more technologically sensible ways of doing these things.
Yeah.
But it's difficult to get people to agree.
Absolutely.
To share that information and make it available when you have to go through the housing trust and
even to
negotiate
just get,
this and that. And
well,
whatever.
Absolutely. But even just to get the resources to do it. You know, I think I realised that I was never going to get the resources to do it whilst I was working in the women's sector. And so I had to get out of the women's sector in order to figure out how to fix that problem. Mm. But it's still the problem that drives me. And that particular conversation and that weekend of worry.
Yeah, well, it's a critical issue, isn't it? It's when you learn,
very much so.
When you learn from people's experiences that you haven't had yourself.
Yeah.
And you can learn so much from other people's. And it inspires you to do other things. So that's
absolutely
great.
It's
inspired you to try and change things, and it certainly needs changing, because that DV area, accommodation, is still a huge issue.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. It's a huge issue. And
I was on the board of the DV Crisis Service before they merged into this latest Women's Safety Service that they have.
Yeah.
And it was always a performance to try and get accommodation for
people. Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. And even, you know, I was watching something on the news this morning, and they were talking about the Zero Project here in Adelaide, and every picture that they used when they talked about homelessness was a picture of a man sleeping rough.
Mm.
I just thought, that's actually not the whole picture of homelessness.
No, it isn't.
And
there's young people and women.
Yeah.
Especially single women. That's really problematic, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Mm. So, yeah, there's still a lot of work to be done. But it did get to the point where I thought, you know, in order to solve some of the problems that I saw at WIS, and not the problems within WIS, what I mean is more the social
problems yeah.
that I needed to move into a space where I had access to greater resources and where I had access to the freedom to not have to worry about day-to-day so much in order to be able to concentrate and then go back and solve some of those problems. But, you know, some of the things that I learned about the strengths of WIS and how to do things was, you know, just the phenomenal amount of work that they do with such small resourcing. Mm. And you know, it doesn't matter how often you come along and say, but we're going to cut your resourcing again, we're going to cut your resourcing again. I don't think it should be cut again, but there was just this resilience and bouncing back of, you know, we'll figure out how to do that and we'll figure out how to change that, and really punching above its weight in terms of the contribution that it makes and the way it is really innovative. You know, we talk now, there's all these buzzwords around community engagement and about co-design, and WIS has been doing this since the 1970s. It's not new.
Yeah, exactly.
It's absolutely not new.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It was just before its time.
Yeah, yeah. I know. Before we had the terminology, we were doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the Women's Information Service for me personally has influenced everything I've done since. Very much so, and I hope to continue to have a working relationship with the Women's Information Service for the rest of my working life. And I think that most people who have worked for the Women's Information Service have that relationship with it, where, you know, if I think back to, you know, Wendy, who was the manager, I think, in the 90s or the early 2000s, and Sandra Dan, who was one of the managers as well, and Sophie Aloesh, and there were all these fantastic women who you leave, but you never really leave. It's a bit like Hotel California. And I think that's one of the real strengths of it.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I think it is true. So what else? What else were we going to ask? I've got so many questions I can talk about. So we've talked about the internet. We've talked about non-English speaking background Aboriginal women. We've talked about... What about country women? We haven't talked about country women.
Yeah, so country women...
So how did WISC manage country women at the time when you were there?
Yeah, so that was through our community engagement program. So that was where we had the information stalls at a number of libraries and community centres. So we had them throughout different parts of regional South Australia. Mm-hmm. And we also had a worker... Shannon, who would go and visit into those communities. So rather than being based in the shopfront, she would go and spend time in various parts of rural South Australia, which was fabulous. And I went with her for a number of those trips. And she had some great projects that she did with, for instance, Roxby Downs, looking at collaboration with Roxby Downs. Well, I'm just trying to think where else. All over South Australia. We had... it had originally...
Is that when they were going to the rural shows and things?
Yeah, yeah. So it had been started up through Drought Reach. So that was just before I had come. Mm-hmm. But acknowledging again that during the drought period that rural women needed some additional support. And so that had happened through that program initially, but we thought it was a real strength of the work that we were doing and continue to do that work, but probably better resourced and in some ways expanded some of that work too, and really identified it as an important part of the community. Because if you're based in Adelaide and you walk along the street, you might accidentally come across Grenfell Street and go in. If you're not based in Adelaide, you're not going to accidentally come across it. And the majority of South Australian women aren't based in Adelaide, so.
And they don't necessarily go to public libraries or places where they might fall over the information.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So whenever Shannon would go out to a community, she'd try and get out to as many other services as she could so that network of service providers knew where we were and how we could help. And she also would communicate with them pretty regularly. So she had a fantastic, you know, much like you had at the Women's, at the Legal Services Commission, Shannon would have a list of people that she would send information to on a regular basis. So the Ombudsman Service was particularly useful for women in rural areas, but there were many others as well. The other thing, the other project that we did whilst I was there that I'm just thinking was a great one, was the pap smear. We did a collaboration about pap smears.
All right, yeah.
So because we didn't have much money, we looked for partners that did have money. And so through the Women's Services Committee, or the Women's Services Network, which was supported and managed by WIS at the time, we started talking about some of the things we were doing there. And the SA Cervix Screening Program with Megan Van Zandt and said, oh, we'd like to come and play with you. Because they had a problem that they weren't allowed to use technology and social media, but they had money. And we were allowed to use technology and social media, but we didn't have money. Mm. So we worked together and we did a beautiful project. We went out to two different groups of young women, one that was a inner city group of young women from a university. The other one was the young mums group from the Parks Community Centre. And we took a GP out with us, and she worked with the two groups of young women to give them lots of really good information about why it was important to have pap smears. And then we took a young filmmaker out with us, and using flip cameras, which is kind of like the phone, the mobile, the camera you have in a mobile phone, she made little videos with them on YouTube, for YouTube, to tell other young women about why they should have pap smears. And they were great. We had a, after that, we had a launch with the minister. We did a red carpet and we had popcorn and we had competitions to get them to share the videos as much as they could. And up until fairly recently, I haven't checked it recently, so this could be out of date, but up until fairly recently, those pap smear videos were still the most viewed videos on the South Australian Government YouTube channel. Yeah. And they were great. And it was this fabulous little project that really, you know, it was about trying to find ways for young women to communicate in their own words and not having government material come across being written by a bureaucrat and, yeah, and doing it in that way. It was about them using it in their own words. Mm. And it was just a beautiful project to be a part of. And it was a, particularly working with the group at the Parkes Community Centre, you know, it was a fabulous example of outreach that we did. Mm. It was just, yeah, it was really good fun.
When you can be having such fun while you're doing it, yeah, really, that's what kept me working so long too, because I kept having ideas, kept getting funding for them and making them happen, and that's very addictive, really.
It's absolutely. I think the other thing that was addictive was trying to figure out how to do things where we didn't have money, so
we just didn't have a budget. Using other people's money, other people's resources, but showing them new ways of reaching out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Information Service has been good at over the years.
Absolutely.
Were you there? Tell me about your relationship with the support group, because you mentioned that Fliss was the coordinator of the support group. How do you think the support group's been important? With Switchboard and its various incarnations, the Women's Information Service, and its how it's been set up and how it's functioned over the years.
The Women's Information Service would not continue to exist if it wasn't for the support group. I'm absolutely sure of that. And the one of the things that I was already aware of when I started in the role was the power of the support group, the political power of the support group. Mm. So before I had started in the role, a couple of years beforehand, I can't remember what the issue was, but there was an issue that the support group had felt so passionately about that they ended up in the minister's office and having conversations with the minister and doing political lobbying about this particular issue. I think it actually might have been when they tried to change the hours before I started. Mm. And so it was, you know, we knew that they were really important, but they were also a real strength. So if you wanted to get out to women across rural South Australia, if you wanted to get out to women, particularly church women, you know, the networks of that support group were phenomenal. And I got to see them in action a few times about a couple of issues, and the phone tree that they could activate at any point in time was really powerful and really, really useful. The WIS support group was probably a bit of a thorn in the side for the minister, which is exactly why they exist, but really appreciated as well, I think, and really, you know, I know that when I was there, members of parliament would actively come along to the meeting, so it wouldn't be uncommon to turn up to a support group meeting with, you know, women from the Catholic Women's League, with Fliss, with women from different rural areas and from the YWCA, CWA, and then to have three or four members of parliament as well. And you don't see that in other organisations.
Right. Yeah, I was one of the first coordinators. I set it up with Betty Fisher.
Ah, yes.
The support group.
Yeah.
Betty said to me, we need this, and this is what we need to do, and this is what you've got to do. And so she organised me, and I went around and did it, basically.
Absolutely.
That was my job. Well, it's one of my jobs when I was first the volunteer.
Absolutely. Yes. And I think it's really good. So
And that was the whole idea, to make sure we had the Liberal women, the Labor women, the Democrats as they were in those days. We had women of all political persuasions. We had every religion was invited.
We had
every single group that we could find at the time
were
part of this support group and encouraged. And even if they didn't come, they'd be set. And we used to get a lot of people coming in the early days.
Yeah, absolutely.
They really were quite big meetings, 30, 40 people.
Whereas,
you know, it did taper off over the years, and probably, and from what I've seen over the years, it has definitely tapered off. But just because people don't come to the meetings doesn't mean you can't stir them
exactly
up
right.
if they need stirring
that's
up.
That's exactly right. Right. Just because they're not there doesn't mean they're not there. And so, so we would have people coming along to the meetings, but we knew just how important they were. And so, you know, Fliss was on the interview panel when I was selected throughout the whole change process of, you know, we knew that if we were going to have some conversations about changing the way we provided services, and particularly if we were going to be looking at shutting the Women's Information Service or reducing the hours of the Women's Information Service, we needed to have the support of the support group. And I hope that we did that. I think we did that. So we, you know, when we had the planning day about the future of the Women's Information Service, the support group were there. The volunteers were there too. And they were part of that decision-making. It wasn't something that happened in a management office and having that decision.
And that's one of the strengths of the organisation.
Absolutely,
really, isn't it?
Absolutely. So when we did make that change, I remember somebody from the minister's office saying to me, "We haven't received one letter of complaint from the support group," and I thought that was great. Like, I wish we weren't in a situation where we had to make those choices, but we were in that situation, and we made those choices together.
And in some states, they don't have women's information services anymore.
No.
And look what's happened to women's health.
Yeah.
It's evaporated into a puff of smoke.
Yeah.
It's tragic.
Yeah.
The Women's Studies Resource Centre, gone.
Yeah.
Working Women's Centre's holding on by the skin of their teeth still.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's not much women's services left that are specific.
No, and I couldn't believe it. Like, I had a bit of an odd path going into the Women's Information Service, because although I'd been an activist at uni and I'd come from the women's sector, I'd gotten burnt out at uni, so I went off and worked in ICT and saw the way in which ICT was funded and how they got money. Then I went to the Women's Information Service and saw the duality of, you know, they were not funded at all well. I've never seen an organisation with such financial pressure. But the flip side was that they had all of these strengths that they didn't have in the ICT sector. But then once I left the Office for Women and WIS, I went into local government. And I turned up on my first day and they said to me, "Oh, I hope it's okay. We've got this budget of something like $50,000 and you need to spend it before the end of the financial year. I'm really sorry. Like, I hope that's okay." I just thought, $50,000? I don't know what to do.
I can find some good things to do with that. Yes, I'll have some plans.
Absolutely. Wow. But it just, you know, we really didn't have...
That's right. It was just a different mindset in local government.
The Women's Information Service really does...
it's always run on the skin of an oily rag,
absolutely.
Really. Yeah. So are there any other things about your time at Switchboard that you've reflected on, or any other issues that you think we need to record today? Because this is your opportunity to sort of put down the historical context of when you were at WIS and what you did and who you knew and how you all operated.
Yeah.
And what you reflect about now. I mean, you've talked about how it's influenced your current work and your future, and you think it always will.
Very much.
But where do you see Switchboard going in the future? Have you got any ideas about...
Yeah. It's interesting. I was going through some, in preparation for this conversation, I was going through some of my old notes, notebooks from when I was there. And, you know, one of the things that I came across was an idea that we'd talked about whilst I was there of being the women's network of all networks. And what we meant by that was, how do you have something like Wikipedia, or how do you have something like the website Mamma Mia, but around the really important issues around domestic violence, sexual assault, homelessness, and so on, and how do you structure that? And I really hope that we figure out how to answer that. And I think that the Women's Information Service has a really important role in driving some of those conversations and the technology that sits behind it. I think we'll see technology becoming more of an enabler into the future, because it just, it gives us the capacity, you know, like when we were talking about the Wiz History Project with Pinterest, it gives us that ability to collaborate in ways that we haven't seen before. So I think we'll see technology becoming more and more important, but I don't think we know how to use it yet.
Mm-hmm.
The other side of it, though, is that I think the Women's Information Service fundamentally understands how to provide good service. And so after I left the Women's Information Service, I went into customer experience inside of government. And this is a big question for not just governments, but for organisations of all sorts, is how do you provide good experience and how do you provide good support to your customers or to your citizens or whatever it might be. And there are things that I think we can learn from the Women's Information Service about how to do that well, not just in terms of some of the technology that we were talking about before with things like how to make a smooth phone call transition, but also about how to respect people, how to empower people to make their own decisions, how to provide good
options,
how to have really well-trained staff and volunteers as well. Like the training programs for volunteers is one of the best training programs I think of any organization. So I think there's lots that we can learn from the Women's Information Service about how to provide good service on a much broader scale, and I'd really like to see the Women's Information Service influencing that in other spaces, like influencing how Centrelink provides their service, for example.
That would be a fine thing, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely. Or housing services. Or, you know, I'd love to see that. And I think that the Women's Information Service can have a really strong role there.
Mm. Yes, because did you know that the Welfare Rights Centre here in Adelaide grew out of Switchboard?
Oh, I didn't know that. I'm not surprised by that. I didn't know that.
We had a worker who had a passion for helping people with Centrelink problems. And Maggie Martinelli ended up working with some, you know, she got a group of people around to help her.
Yeah.
And they set up the Women's, the Welfare Rights Centre. Sadly, they've just lost their funding last year, the Welfare Rights Centre, and I think it's gone to one of the charities.
So, okay, yeah.
Which I think was a great shame, because they lost all the expertise of the staff.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is a real problem, I think. Small organisations that are not very well funded are problematic, and with the current politics, there was no interest in the Commonwealth government in funding people to get assistance to deal with Centrelink. But that's what they should be doing.
Yeah.
Because until people get support and encouragement and help to deal with the labyrinth complexities of Centrelink, I mean, it's not a just and equitable society.
Well, no.
Is it?
Absolutely not.
And, you know, that infuriated me. And I must admit, I do have a little bit of a political stance that they shouldn't be giving all the money to the charities rather than funding organisations to work in a non-government sector. I don't think it's a good idea, because they then rely upon the good nature of the people who work there. The charities don't pay them as well, the terms and conditions aren't as fair. There's a whole lot of things that don't quite work once you get into that other space. And I'm really concerned about the political shift into the sort of non the charitable sector of services. Yeah. That does bother me, I must confess.
Yeah, yeah. There's some interesting conversations around. So one of the buzz terms, lots of buzz terms around at the moment is this social enterprise space. And I think it's one that has the capacity to potentially be really interesting and do some really good things, but it also has the capacity to exploit people. So I think for me, the jury's still out on what will happen into the future. But, you know, as much as I am sad to see, and I'm genuinely sad to see, the former models of funding and support for things like the Women's Information Service and the Working Women's Centre and, you know, all those phenomenal organisations go, I mean, the reality is it's just not there anymore. The funding just isn't there.
But that's choices people make to keep it from...
Oh, absolutely.
I know services need to change and shift to deal with new demands, but I think I was hoping that one day we wouldn't need a Women's Information Service, we wouldn't need domestic violence crisis services, you know, women's safety strategies. You know, in an ideal world, these would not be necessarily.
Yeah.
But sadly, we haven't got to that ideal
world. No, we haven't got to that ideal world.
And yet there's funding for, you know, bank, you know, managing directors of banks get paid appalling amounts of money.
Yeah.
You know, there's a very inequitable society we're living in where people are paid ridiculous amounts of money for doing their jobs and other people aren't given enough to provide services to people who really need them.
Absolutely. And I think maybe that's where there needs to be a fundamental refocusing of what needs to happen into the future. And, you know, I was very happy last week when the marital equality debate passed through.
Finally.
But, you know, the reality for me in my life at the moment is that I have a beautiful little girl who I'm she calls me mum and I'm her legal parent, and she is Aboriginal and she has spent time in foster care and she faces so much disadvantage. You know, she lives with me because her home was unsafe and because there was so much domestic violence in her home, and you know, her mum experienced generations of removal. And I'm really glad that the marriage equality debate is behind us, because those are the issues that I think we need to start focusing on. And, you know, I've got a very, very white little boy who is 4 months old and who will probably grow up in a world where he's not really discriminated against for anything. And I've got a little girl who's not much older and is not facing that reality.
Already she's facing. Yeah. Oh, that's right. We've got a long way to go. And that $120 million could have been better spent on that Uluru statement or other things, couldn't it?
Absolutely. Even just stuff like, you know, trying to get the police clearances so that we could look after her. You know, there wasn't even a process for us to be able to do that kind of stuff. So, you know, basic things that just need to be addressed, and we would expect are addressed in every other part of life. You know, if you can, I've got groceries being delivered to me later on today that I ordered online last night at 11 o'clock at night, and I expect that now. I should expect the same level of service when it comes to things like domestic violence, sexual assault, homelessness, foster care. There's no reason why we're not seeing that. And I think unless we start to refocus on those questions...
We've got to change the political conversation, haven't we?
And it might look different to the way it looked in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, but the issues are the same.
Oh, yeah, they haven't gone away.
No.
Well, that for me, that was one of the blessings of WIS, is working with people like Joanne Wilmot and Tanya Hosh and Dot Davy and some of the other Aboriginal women. I learnt so much from those women that I would never have learnt in my white middle class background.
Yeah.
I had missed out those opportunities, and I'm eternally grateful for those opportunities that I had with that I wouldn't have had otherwise.
Absolutely.
And so that lent me, when I went to the commission, it meant that when I was finding students for my law courses, I looked for Aboriginal students first, then I looked for students from new and emerging communities next, and then I looked for students who worked in domestic violence or women's services or disability services. They were my next priority. And if there were any places left over, I'd let a few government people sneak in.
Yeah.
I totally discriminated in favour of the sort of people who I thought needed the information.
Yeah.
And, that was one of the bits of fun I had in my job, being able to do that. But I would never have occurred to me to do that if I hadn't had the same...
The experience
of seeing what empowering people can be like and learning from these other people who shared their lives so generously with us.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I hope that the Women's Information Service continues to exist, and I think it will continue to exist. I think it's going to start to look different, because I think that the way we interact in terms of community, in terms of society, is different than the way it was 10 years ago, the way it was 20 years ago. It is different. But I hope it does continue to exist. And regardless of whether it continues to exist or not, you know, I know that, using myself as an example, I've come through the Women's Information Service. I've learnt a lot. I'm now going and doing other things, but I'm doing those other things with the full information and experience that's come from WIS. And, you know, I really hope that I can continue to do some work that is good, but I'm really clear of just how much the Women's Information Service influences all of the work that I do now and all of the things that I want to achieve.
I just worry. I must say, I do worry about how we make sure that the people who are at the lower rungs of society, who are much more disadvantaged than us, how we make sure that they get access to all the services that we have access to. Because I think there is still... technology is a wondrous thing, but it's not equitably distributed still.
It's not equitably distributed, but it's... what it does... So my daughter has Aboriginal grandparents who live in Cape York. Yeah. Her grandparents have experienced generations of removal
and disadvantage,
have children who have experienced huge amounts of generational disadvantage, prison, homelessness, or all sorts of problems. What technology does is enables my daughter to maintain that connection with her Aboriginal family, even though she can't live with them. And that's the kind of... She can Skype them, she can Google them. We watch on YouTube videos of all of the traditional language and songs with other kids in the community that she would be living in
if she was there.
Mm. So I completely agree that it's not yet equitable. But what I think it does is provides us with tools that we wouldn't have otherwise.
New ways of doing things, yeah, I agree. Yeah. And I'm really happy that we do that. I just want to make sure it does happen. That's what worries me. That some people don't take that as a priority, and that's what worries me.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Because you were saying about the internet being very male-dominated in the early days, I still think it's very much education-dominated, and it's the people who are more disadvantaged don't have the same equitable access.
So that's what I thought too. But I think I've changed my mind on that.
Good. So, well, I'd be really happy I hope it is changing.
I'm not saying there's not problems. There are problems. But, so, you know, before when I was talking about the problems, we're trying to figure out where the accommodation was at night. So on a different night, we were desperately trying to find some accommodation for somebody else. And we were ringing around and we were ringing around and we were ringing around and we couldn't get through to anyone because it was late in the afternoon and all of the phone lines were busy and we couldn't get through to find out where to put someone. And we said, we're just really struggling to find accommodation for this woman tonight. And she said, I know where it is. And she got out her phone and she called one of her friends and she said, hey, are you at Catherine House tonight? And she said, yeah. Can you just ask them, have they got a spare room at the moment? She said, yeah, I'm just here at the moment. I'll just go and ask. And she said, yeah, they've got a spare room. Send her over. So the technology, I'd assumed that technology wasn't being used or wasn't as equitable. And what I really missed there was that maybe it was just being used in ways that weren't the same as the way I was using it.
Well, you couldn't do it by official channels, but by unofficial channels it was still possible.
That's right.
Well, that's heartening, because I do worry about that sometimes.
And I think there's a place for worry, but I think there's also, you know, it comes back to that question of who's creating things, and if we can find ways to make sure that technology is being created by a diversity of people, then I think we've got the opportunity to create some things that can change and that can create opportunity. The YouTube videos that we watch of the Aboriginal community are of the kids doing raps in... so they had a hip-hop artist who went out to the community and was doing... rap about eating healthy food. And so there's all this language. I mean, she can see other kids in the community. There's all this language that she gets access to because it's on YouTube. She can see different locations and things like that. But it was, you know, it wasn't the government coming in and doing a documentary.
No.
It was a local hip-hop act.
That's great. That's the sort of stuff you need to have access to, and that's terrific that you're able to provide that access.
Yeah.
Well, that's the sort of stuff that I hope happens,
but
I wonder how often it does happen.
Absolutely. And there's definitely problems, but, you know, it's going to keep me busy for a while.
Yeah. Oh, the AP Wildlands, there are such issues up there still, and it's such a beautiful place. Just absolutely stunningly beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
We probably should conclude our interview.
Thank you very much.